It is summer now, summer 1960. And unless the stock market skids into an abyss, or the world comes even closer to blowing itself up than it is now, we Americans are probably going to be talking endless politics during the next months. Certainly, a whole coterie of TV programs will discuss the chances of this or that candidate, what he would do if elected, and other matters. We of the open mind thought we would go at it somewhat differently. We would ask the questions, despite all the hullabaloo, are there any real differences between a Democrat and a Republican now? And if there are, what are these differences? Now, this discussion will go over 2 weeks, one part of it this week and one part the next. And these programs, like all open mind programs, have very few ground rules, but we did agree that, for the most part, we would leave foreign affairs to next week's discussion. All of our panelists today, just as you and I, probably have their party choices. But I think I need hardly say that they are appearing here not as advocates of any particular party, but as students of politics, which they certainly are. Here to my right, Mr. Walter Johnson, professor of American history at the University of Chicago, and a man of considerable practical political experience on both the local and national level, all of which is shown in his new astute study of presidential leadership, which is entitled 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In the center, Mr. Richard Rovere, distinguished political commentator for The New Yorker, Harper's, and other journals, and author of the recent bestseller, Senator Joe McCarthy. And across from me, Mr. Robert Bingham, managing editor of that influential journal, The Reporter. Gentlemen, may I start you off this way? Holiday Magazine has an article this month on the Republican Party, which says this: a 1960 Republican is a Democrat, only less so. The Republican accepts much the same general policies, but the Democrat is for them joyfully, wholeheartedly. The Republican, reluctantly and gingerly. Mr. Johnson, would you begin this by a comment, please?
Well, Mr. Goldman, I think it's a very fortunate thing in our history that our two parties haven't been ideological, so they would split the country. On the other hand, I would say that since Teddy Roosevelt left the White House, and this probably agrees with this statement that you just read, that the Republicans have been about 10 to 15 years behind the Democrats in helping the American people adjust to the great changes of the 20th century.
Mr. Revere?
I'm not sure that it's a good thing. I think there are certain advantages to having this coalition system in a nation like ours. I think it's a perfectly true thing in general that the differences between our major parties are far less than the differences between among European parties. I think one can pin some ideological differences down, and I'd hope that we might get around to trying it later on.
Yeah. Mr. Bingham?
The candidates demand that the other candidates make the issues clear, and the other candidates insist they have made the issues clear. It seems to me that in a fundamental sense, there are no great issues. They've been settled over the course of the last generation. A generation ago, we were divided in this country on two important questions: whether the government had a responsibility to maintain certain limited standards of living for the American people, and whether the government should participate actively and expensively in foreign affairs. Look about us today, and these issues have been settled. As has been said, the Republicans have caught up with the Democrats. If it is a difference, it's a difference of degree only. I'd put it very much as that statement you quoted was. I'd say that Democrat is a man who wants to expand the powers of the government. The Republican tends to be a man who wants to limit the powers of government.
Well, one way of trying to dig into this question would be the issues way, which we will certainly get into. Before we do that, perhaps something that Mr. Revere suggests this to me, we would ask, is there any real difference, generally speaking, between the kind of person who tends to be a Republican and a Democrat, before we get to the issues? Now, I notice Vance Packard, in his Status Seekers book, which summarizes a great deal of sociological finding of the last 10 years, says that if you will give him these four factors, he'll tell you 9 out of 10 whether the man is a Democrat or a Republican. These are the four factors: the money factor, which he says is increasing, income factor, the ancestry factor, the distance from the center of the city factor, and whether you're an egghead or not.
Well, that's all very cute, and some of it is right, but if I understand the 1950s, the Democrats are the majority party of this nation. True, not in the presidency, but in Congress and in local elections, and therefore It must be awfully high income just to make you a Republican. Because there are a lot of middle-income people who apparently vote Democratic, at least for Congress.
Yeah, so I think there's no doubt of that. And I think that there's been a lot of exaggerated talk about the fact Eisenhower's victory proved that he had attracted independent voters. I don't think any such thing. Stevenson held on to the Democrats and the independents, if you look at the total figures. What Eisenhower got, it seems to me, were the people who don't usually vote and who don't really care much about politics. In terms of politics, I think there's no doubt the Democratic Party is still the majority party.
And, Mr. Bingham, look at it another way. It seems to me some recent studies have demonstrated quite clearly that those who don't come out to vote are usually those with a lower education and lowest income.
Who don't like politics, who would like to pick someone who would rise above politics in some vague sense.
Now, Mr. Packard did not say that the four or five had to be taken all together, did he?
He wants them together, as I understand it, Mr. Revere, yeah.
Well, I would agree that he can't have them that way. No. There aren't that many.
But look, Mr. Goldman, before we get involved in all this, what about the differences within the parties? Talk about the Republican and the Democrat. Seems to me that one has to make a distinction between the National Republican Party, the Congressional Republican Party, the National Democratic Party, and the Congressional Democratic Party.
It's the result of a kind of gerrymandering, isn't it? The people who get elected to Congress are, by and large, elected from rural districts, whereas the presidency is controlled by the big cities, where the Democrats have traditionally had their power.
And go and push that a little further, Mr. Bingham. The people who control the congressional committees come from safe districts, whether they be Republican or Democratic, which means they have no competition in their primaries. Take the wonderful example that's in your book, Crucial Decade, of 1948. Mr. Dewey tried to run on a national platform to appeal to the mass of Americans. What was he hamstrung by? The record of the 80th Congress, which had been controlled by very antique type of Republicans who had not accepted the great changes that you mentioned earlier, Mr. Bingham. They simply fought the great changes. Dewey was licked by Truman's great skill in emphasizing that the Congressional Republican Party was the Republican Party.
And I want to say again, the only Republican who has won is the Republican who rises above politics, not who has advanced a political position which is more attractive to people who are political in.
Mr. Revere.
Nevertheless, even in 48, there was some difference. Truman's majority, the presidential Democratic majority, was a good deal greater, if I recall, than the Democratic congressional majority. Is it not?
Yes, it was.
Well, now, do I take you men to be saying...
Not by much, is that true?
As I recall,
just by a bit.
I thought he was helped considerably by the...
Well, he's helped.
There were states
in
which he ran
some
behind,
gubernatorial
candidates were,
helped him, like Stevenson in Illinois or...
there were still two different parties.
Yeah.
Do I take you men to be saying that if you limit this exclusively to presidential elections, which, of course, you were not doing it, that these factors are not really holding?
I rather think that... There's a dichotomy in the mind of individual voters on this. I notice that the polls now, while they keep showing Kennedy so much ahead of Nixon and Stevenson, showing Democratic majorities in terms of names at the moment, they also show, every time the question of foreign policy is posed, they show that a fair majority at this stage of development thinks that the Republicans are better equipped, at least at the stage before these last few weeks, to manage things. I think it's entirely conceivable that an individual voter would think, I'd like to have a Republican president, and I'd like to have Democrats representing me in Congress.
They seem to have thought that for the last several elections.
So well, doesn't this come back to the point that in the 50s, the Democrats have the greatest appeal nationally, congressionally, presidential-wise, when there's a dip in the economy, a recession, if you will, and after all, we had two in the 50s, and these contributed in 54 and 58 to a Democratic Congress. But when the foreign policy issue comes in, in this past decade at least, the Democrats are on the defensive.
Couldn't you go further and say that the expansionist activities of any political party are prompted by crisis rather than a lot of professors sitting in a room figuring out what would be a nice program? I mean, if Roosevelt had known what he was going to do during the 30s and had set it down as a program, it seems to me he would have been a much less attractive candidate than he was because of the sort of vague, reassuring presence.
Much less effective president, too.
Of course. I believe in this sort of vague grouping.
I
think it's effective for our form of government.
To suggest a difference that has something to do with the kind of people they are, but is also, I think, an ideological difference of sorts and an important distinction. And I would state it by saying that, in a general way, Democrats are people who believe in government and like it.
And want to expand the role of government.
Well, yes, want to expand it, but who believe in it and see, think they see possibilities. Republicans in general, I think, just want the least possible government.
If I may interrupt, Professor Rossiter of Cornell has a neat way of putting that same thing in a rather cynical way, it seems to me. He says, Democrats are people who want the government to spend more money on them. Republicans are people who want the government to let them keep the money they have. There is undoubtedly an element of self-interest in all of our
political
deliberations.
I've heard the distinction made in terms of, have you heard this, the way a man prepares a drink? That a Republican, when he prepares a highball, takes a jigger and measures out the whiskey. A Democrat, he just pours.
All right, let me pick that up. Let me pick that up then, Mr. Goldman. Let me propose that it seems to me the Democrats have been more vigorous, more imaginative, and more controversial within their own ranks.
This is an entirely nonpartisan statement.
Look how many ballots it took to nominate a presidential candidate in 1924. What was it, 104, as I remember? Took 44 ballots, didn't it, to nominate Woodrow Wilson? Now, the Republicans are much better organized, it seems to me, more systematized, if you are. But 10 days ago, of course, my statement got upset a little because when Mr. Rockefeller issued his blast, it looked to me as though they were going to act like Democrats.
He sounded like a Democrat not only because of what he said, but because of the rudeness with which he was.
Well, the whole idea of controversy, you
more
say.
Typical
the Democrats
of the Democrat
row
party.
All the time.
Yeah.
Well, after all, his statement was written by a Democrat.
Of course.
Things hold, yes.
I wonder if the reason the Democrats are more chaotic isn't that they have historically tried to be an inclusive party. When the wave of immigrants came, Tammany Hall was very glad to see them, and they gave them hods of coal and found them jobs. And I think this was a worthwhile service to assimilate these people into our democratic form of government. But in a way, they've sort of done themselves out of a job now.
Because well, but
now
they also had to blend the Southern Democrat with the immigrants.
Well, that's
remember
what I was
that,
hoping
too.
We'd get to. Because
yes.
One of the big blocks in this city, it's no doubt that the Democrats have their power mostly in the cities and the Republicans in the rural areas. I think
suburbs.
One of the blocks that gives a great sign of breaking up, I would think, is the Negroes. There are 18 million Negroes in this country, and they are centered largely in the South, but also in the urban centers that the Democrats have traditionally held under the New Deal and the Fair Deal.
Well, before we move there, and I think we have about as good, that is, a muddy picture of what the rank and file of the parties are as one can get, is there anything in the leadership of the parties that characterizes them? Secretary of Commerce, ex-Secretary of Commerce Humphrey, who sometimes was a shrewd man, I think remarked that the Democrats are led by people who inherited their money, and the Republicans are led by people who made their money. Run down the list, and it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a very...
Stevenson, Harriman, and of course Rockefeller, who's acting like a Democrat, so to speak, you see, as opposed to the other type. Yeah. Is this a permanent phenomenon? Is it meaningful?
Noblesse oblige on the part of those who have old wealth who feel a responsibility? Possibly, yes, but this isn't true of your congressional Democrats out of the big cities. You're talking about the presidential.
Presidential and the top.
Yes,
top.
That's
right. It's true to a degree among congressional Democrats, Senate Democrats.
People like
Clark,
Joe Clark, yeah.
Well, you
Lehman.
Have to be rich to be in politics, after all, in this country.
It helps. Degree. It helps.
It's hard to run for the Senate without having some money someplace.
Well, this is not, Mr. Bingham, not simply richness. It's richness and aristocracy.
I have it in mind. I remember there's a wonderful story about Roosevelt that seemed to tell a lot about him. He was lost some money on a business deal once, and somebody, his wife, I believe, said, well, now we've got to worry about the children going to school, and he said, oh, don't worry, Mama will take care of them. There had been enough wealth, not a great deal of wealth, but enough wealth so that he didn't worry about money, whereas your self-made man who's made it himself is not so sure that it's going to be there all the time. But he's more nervous about holding on to it.
Yeah. First generation money Republican, second or third Democratic.
And this Republican trait that you are developing then, Mr. Goldman, makes them more cautious when they're in the government, more status quo,
and
not
more
keeping
business-minded, so to speak.
Right.
Wouldn't it? More business-minded. Your Symington, your Kennedy, your Stevenson, your Harriman, etc., are men who, in a sense, can feel themselves a little above business or apart from business. The money was made, as Mr. Revere was saying, several generations ago. Yes. I didn't mean to divert things too far from getting into the domestic program now, which is where we were heading. I think, Mr. Revere, you felt that strong differences appear there.
Well, I don't know. No, I don't know as I'd say strong. I tried to suggest one of them when I said that this simple approach to government and to the uses of government seems to me an important one. I don't, as far as issues are concerned, it seems to me that about the most one can say is that while they overlap in general and almost all divisions of opinion can be found in both parties, you can say that as a general rule, the Republicans exclude an extreme welfare state bloc, and the Democrats exclude an extreme anti-welfare state.
All right, let's
block,
pick it up on a precise issue. Medical,
yes.
Medical aid for the aged.
Yeah.
Seems
they're talking only about techniques, though, aren't they? The responsibility of the government to help aged people.
Yeah, how far you go.
Is agreed by both parties. It's a question of how it will be done.
Well, that's where reluctance, the thing that Mr. Goldman read comes in. I mean, the Republicans have been under Democratic pressure to get in on this thing. I think if it weren't for the pressure, they wouldn't be in it at all.
Well, I wonder if we could touch on race, because I think that's the real central issue.
Well, Mr. Bingham, you raised the Negro vote.
I think that's the thing that gets people excited.
In Chicago, 71% of the Negroes voting voted for Stevenson in 52 and about the same for Truman in 48. But in 56, there was a 5-7% drop-off, which went to Eisenhower.
This is the thing I think is going to be.
And this, of course, is very significant because of this important block in a big city. And as you pointed out earlier, Mr. Bingham, the 12 largest cities in this country, if the one party can carry them, carries the whole electoral vote of those 10 states, and they've got within 30 electoral votes of the presidency.
Roosevelt managed to win over the Negroes from the party of Lincoln, by and large, and they trusted him. But now, what do they see? They see that the Supreme Court decision was made by a court in which the Chief Justice, at least, was a Republican appointee.
Mr. Nixon said it was made by a Republican court.
Well, I think that's most unfortunate.
But
his record
is looked on favorably by a number of Negroes, and Attorney General Rogers' record is better than many Democratic politicians.
Well, you're talking about, again, the difference within the party. The Southern Democrats, of course, are hopeless.
Yeah, but I think this may become a difference between the parties if the Republicans take the opportunity that is open to them. I doubt if they don't seem to be. Eisenhower won 5 of the 11 Southern states in 1956, but there's very little attempt by the Republicans to work there and set up.
This is as far from an ideological difference, though, it seems to me, as you could get. It's a difference that grows out of...
But most of the important issues are far from ideological issues, aren't they? I mean, they're issues that people feel strongly about personally.
Well, then,
it's bread and butter and...
Well, no, I think there is an idea. I think you might say, for example, that while attitude toward race may not be an ideological issue, attitudes toward legislation having to do with it involves ideology.
Yeah.
And
the sessions of 56, 57, 58, Mr. Johnson, correct me if I'm wrong, did the administration, at least on the face of it, not take a stronger civil rights position than the majority of Democrats in the Senate?
No, I don't think the administration did. Attorney General Rogers sent over to the Congress, as you know, Mr. Revere, better than I do, in 57, a very strong bill. But then it got emasculated partly by the President of the United States at a press conference.
Yes, the bill itself originally was stronger than the Democratic bill.
Yes,
and the administration doesn't push it.
Yeah, but a Democratic bill, I mean, the Democrats have the advantage or disadvantage of being on both sides of this issue. I mean, the most ardent champions of Negro rights are in the Democratic Party, and the most ardent opponents of Negro rights are in the Democratic Party.
But in 57, it seems to me, an interesting thing happened in American politics. After all, the 14th Amendment's been on the books since the post-Civil War period. There was plenty of time to have put this into effect at any time. But there had always been an arrangement, as you know, a coalition of Southern Democrats and conservative congressional Republicans who blocked anything in civil rights. In 57, some smart political man in the White House, I assume Sherman Adams, insisted that the Congressional Republican Party work with the Northern Democrats, and you got your first civil rights legislation since Reconstruction. So you needed a coalition.
But then at about the same time, wasn't a emasculating coalition formed of Southern Democrats and far Western or mountain state, low population state Democrats in the Senate?
Like Wayne Morris, who is...
I don't mean that. I mean that that there has been... The Southern Democrats have found allies.
That's what I meant.
In the states, right. Well, Wayne Morris was on the other side.
Didn't he swing over on the civil rights issue? Wasn't there a deal there? It doesn't matter.
But Mr. Revere's point is a very good one.
These alliances between the parties we've been talking about are sure, sooner or later, to have some effect on the parties themselves. And the the uncomfortable alliances within the parties are under severe strain.
Well, don't they? Historically, they have continuing effects on the parties, don't they? And keep changing the nature of them. Well, wasn't you said that the country was divided 20 years ago, and of course it, or 30 years ago, and of course it was, but it was not divided along party lines until Roosevelt came along and formed a coalition.
The Democrats weren't known as champions of Negro rights.
No, but in the 30s, that wasn't really the issue. The issue then was economic opportunity for the Negro, and that came during the war.
Aren't we confusing two things here? One is the general domestic approach to these parties. Now, there seemed to be agreement around the table on that. Namely, is this right? That the Democrats were more willing to use federal powers and more willing to spend money to bring about certain social changes. Is that right?
I agree, yes.
The people who voted for them thought they were going to benefit.
Now, then this is a kind of ideological difference, if you will, ideology on a low level. Then we got over into race relations, and I think it was you, Mr. Revere, who was saying that this difference being discussed here is not ideological. That is, both sides, nationally at least, are for civil rights.
Yes.
What seems to happen is that as you execute them, different things occur, and it's the different things that aren't very clear yet.
Well, one thing that has happened is that the Negroes have become an important force in American politics. They're a large group, and they can and their favor can be bid for, and has to be.
And they vote very heavily in the northern cities.
And I think that that is. Has nothing to do with ideology.
Well, as I said before, I think American politics is a long and glorious history of non-ideology in which good things are accomplished by a sort of chaotic process which works out quite well for this
country. Mr. Goldman, may I come back to a point Mr. Revere made about changing parties? The parties change quite dramatically depending on who is president of the party, for instance. And it would seem to me one acute difference in the 20th century is that with the exception of Theodore Roosevelt, the Republican Party has not had a vigorous leader in the White House, a man who utilized the full power of the pulpit of the White House to help adjust to change, whether it be domestic or international, whereas the Democrats have had two,
this is not an accident, that their commitment is to limiting the powers of the federal government, so they select people who are not advocates of a strong presidency. People criticize Eisenhower for not having taken a stronger political stand, but in a way he would have violated the pledges he made to the American people
absolutely.
If he had been a strong politician.
This is his view and the view of most Republicans.
He believes in being a chief magistrate.
But it wasn't the view of Teddy Roosevelt.
He was
a powerful leader in the White House. So you talk about tradition, all right, you could go back 40 years or 50 years, you've got the tradition of strong leadership.
He, like Governor Rockefeller, may found himself running on a bull moose ticket before he was through.
Well, do we have hold of something solid here now that on the question of the conception of presidential leadership, the modern conception of the Republicans has been for a weaker president, the modern conception of
the Democrats? I don't think they'd call it weak. I mean, they believe in limiting the activities of the central government. They think that more power, the more power can be left to the states and individuals, the healthier.
Well, also, Mr. Bingham, you do talk about the co-equal nature of the branches of government, the presidency and the Congress. But whenever a president talks that way, it seems to me Congress then takes over and runs our government. And in the great difficulties we face on, say, civil rights or on the international crisis, I don't think Congress can lead the country.
No.
It can make contributions.
The point you make is that
lead.
In this, if there's a vacuum, the stakes are so high that somebody is going to occupy it.
Well, and Congress has historically, whenever we've had weak presidents.
Well, now, are we talking here in this conception of presidential leadership about something which these parties believe in, or about the accident of the men they happen to nominate? Would Mr. Nixon, for example, continue with a conception of a less active presidency?
No, I don't think so, and I think Mr. Nixon may provide another break of thoughts if he gets it. On race, for example, I think it's no accident at all, but it's part of Mr. Eisenhower's ideology that he has said, I will keep hands off this thing as much as I can. Mr. Nixon has said that he believes that a president ought to move in.
Or at least he's told reporters
yes.
He said that it is his view that he ought to
move in. Well, Mr. Nixon has several men who tell reporters his view, and I think they're fairly authentic. And I'm sure that he would. I'm sure that...
I am too.
I mean, Nixon went down into Texas 4 years ago and flashed an NAACP card, you know, and said, I'm a member of this. And I think the first person high in Public Affairs to have done anything of the
sort.
Well,
Mr. Goldman, it seems to me that a president these days finds himself in three tough roles. Unifier of the nation, chief of state, if you will. Party leader, or chief prime minister, chief legislator, and then the head of his party. Now, I would agree...
Traveler.
Well, I don't want to add that. You may add that, Mr. Ophir. And it would seem to me that Vice President Nixon will function effectively and vigorously as party leader, no doubt about that.
Yes.
And as chief legislator. I doubt that he'll function as successfully in this third role of unifier of the country.
Well, that's the question whether he'll be elected, I think.
Yes, quite.
As we've said, the Democratic Party is the majority party. The way for a Republican to be elected is to prove that he is more than a Republican so that he can attract,
I suppose. Of course, there is a sense in which Mr. Eisenhower did function, as I think, in his first term as a unifier.
Oh, he did.
Of
well,
the country.
This is where he's functioned
yes.
most admirably.
Yes, contribution. And, well, it was surely for the first 4 years. And he functioned in a way by not functioning. I mean, he functioned by simply being there. And.
But I claim that no one should have been surprised that he did this, because that
no,
was really
I,
the program
agree
on which
you,
he...
Yes.
Was elected. I think there's no doubt that, as you've said, the Republicans have been catching up with the Democrats. And one way they've caught up is a realization that we need, in these times, a strong presidency. I think Mr. Nixon is committed to a fairly aggressive use
well,
of the presidential
power. Well, now, gentlemen, on these issues we've been talking about today, leaving out race, on the issues of presidential leadership and on general domestic policy, seems to me have made some rather important differences between the Democrats and Republicans.
Well, I would add another issue we haven't talked about, federal aid to education.
Well, this
the,
would be the part of the general domestic program.
Yeah, sure.
But it isn't a matter of attitudes rather than ideology. I mean, the basic principles are accepted, at least in words, by both parties. But I think they have a very different approach to the way in which those ideologies should be worked out.
And I don't see how you're going to get, say, federal aid to education unless you have a president who insists it really is must legislation, not just put it in the State of the Union message, but go after congressmen to support the legislation. This
yes,
we haven't
or,
seen.
Yeah.
Yes.
And yet a Republican might have been able to do it more easily than a Democrat if he had so chosen.
Oh, I wouldn't doubt that, Mr. Mayor.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, I'm going to have to cut in on this first part of our discussion. For it, thank you, Mr. Walter Johnson of the University of Chicago, Mr. Richard Rovere, and Mr. Robert Bingham of Reporter Magazine. Last week, we began a two-part discussion revolving around the questions, despite all the hullabaloo, is there any real difference between a Democrat and a Republican? And if there are real differences, what are they? In our leisurely way, we roamed through such questions as who socially and economically is a Democrat and a Republican? And we discussed a number of domestic programs, including especially the race problem. As we move on today, I hope we will be able to get into the vital area and discuss fully, is there a difference in foreign policy matters? Our panel remains the same. To my right, Mr. Walter Johnson, professor of American history at the University of Chicago and author of the new shrewd analysis of presidential leadership entitled 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. In the center, Mr. Richard Rovere, the distinguished political commentator for Harper's, The New Yorker, and other journals. And across from me, Mr. Robert Bingham, managing editor of the well-known and influential journal, Reporter Magazine. Frequently, I begin these discussions by quoting a distinguished authority. So let me begin today by quoting a very distinguished gentleman, Mr. Walter Johnson. Last week, in discussing the difference between a Republican and a Democrat, you said a Republican is a gentleman who is some 10 or 15 years behind a Democrat, or words to that effect, in his policies. We talked about this in the domestic area. Is it true in the foreign area?
Well, let me approach it this way, Mr. Goldman. In the late 1940s, the Democratic Party brought in a number of very important innovations in our foreign policy, the Marshall Plan, NATO Point 4, of course, with the important help of Senator Vandenberg, Republican, in the Senate. Then in the early 50s, Secretary Dulles issued a number of statements about foreign policy. You all remember them. Instant massive retaliation, unleash Chiang Kai-shek, liberation. But after you got under the words, if you watched, he was continuing the old containment policy that was so brilliantly developed by, say, George Kennan, who was one of the brains here in that administration. And they did not realize, it seems to me, that containment was a policy for the 40s, maybe early 50s, but it has to be changed. You have to adjust to this technology that we're living in the world. So I would argue that viewing for public opinion as static, the Eisenhower administration has not brought in new innovations in foreign policy.
Mr. Rivera, I see you
nodding. Yes, well, I'd agree to the to that in general. I think there's a certain, when you get into foreign policy, there's a certain confusion. There's always somewhat more continuity in foreign policy in our government and in all governments, I think, than in domestic policy. And it was, it so happened that the Democrats were in power when the issue was raised, and they had to, when the Cold War began in 47, and they had to respond to it. And I think we probably all assume that they responded in the national interests, and the Republicans pursued the policy, and that Mr. Dulles's words were little more than words, that he was trying to talk about a change that for the most part didn't exist. I think it did somewhat, but essentially it was he was giving new and bolder, or he thought bolder language to...
Well, if anything, he extended containment by a number of treaties.
Yes, but instant retaliation had always been our policy, except the words hadn't been...
Mr. Bingham, would you comment to this general point?
Well, I think that there are undoubtedly differences in attitudes and degrees, but in the overall point of view, I think that there is basic agreement. As late as 1941, the vote on the Lend-Lease Bill was split almost exactly on partisan lines. There were people who were not embarrassed to be called isolationists. A few weeks ago, we had the spectacle of Republican legislators in Washington attempting to persuade Democratic legislators not to cut a Republican president's foreign aid bill too much. I think the, starting from the quotation from Mr. Johnson, the Republicans have caught up a great deal. Under the pressure of the Second World War and the great problems we face, I think there just aren't fundamental questions about our responsibility and our actions in foreign
affairs. No, I agree. They've caught up much faster than on domestic
politics.
There was
a very neat irony in that last situation last couple of weeks ago, of course, when the leader of the spenders was John Tabor of New York, who was
Mr. Passman.
And Mr. Passman, Democrat of Louisiana, was the shredder of foreign aid, but that was not so ironic, I think, as Mr. Tabor's own individual role 10 years ago.
Well, isn't this the result of President Eisenhower's conversion of Congressman Tabor?
I think President Eisenhower has legitimized and made acceptable this coming up to the Democrats and among the Republicans. But I think it's the pressure of events. I mean, nobody is an isolationist anymore. No one would advocate cutting off foreign aid or not recognizing our responsibilities.
Well, a few do.
Very few,
of course,
a few would. But I think, by and large, we talk not about political leaders, but about a Democrat and a Republican. Mm-hmm. Almost any place you go in this country, there is general acceptance of the fact that we are in foreign affairs to stay, and for a long battle with the Russians.
Senator Dirksen, the minority leader at the present time, was in Congress in the start of the last Great War, and I came not long ago upon a statement of his saying that if they let Roosevelt go any further at all, this was after the Detroit for Bases, I think, before we knew it, he would declare Bermuda essential to the national defense of the United States. And, of course, Senator Dirksen is now leading...
He's been on all sides of all issues, as you know.
I think this is a kind of progress, a kind of line of development that characterizes the last 20 years.
Well, I don't have one thing clear here. In last week's discussion, you gentlemen made a kind of key difference in domestic policy, a greater willingness on the part of the Democrats to use the federal government and to spend money to further certain social changes. Now, are you saying the same difference exists in foreign affairs, or that the difference has been reversed, as it were? Who is it that wants to spend the money and use governmental powers to advance, let us say, a policy of containment, which both of them agree upon? Or is it so blurred that you can't tell?
Well, I would answer that, Mr. Goldman, by suggesting that it isn't a question of either party not using full power of the federal government in foreign policy. Obviously, this will happen now in the future. What I'm saying is that I think we need innovation at the present moment, new policies to meet the demands of the 1960s, and I don't see that we had much innovation in the 50s. Let me give you one example. The president alone can form foreign policy. I'm convinced of this, although Congress can modify, can even defeat at times. 2 years ago, Senator Fulbright suggested that the Development Loan Fund of our government be put on a 5-year basis so that you wouldn't have to come up against this annual appropriation fight in Congress. It was the administration that said no because of its domestic conservatism on fiscal policy. I think this was a mistake. Here was a healthy suggestion in a very important new agency, and it was turned down.
Well, now, before we get into this question of what they should be doing, though, have we answered clearly this question as to whether, let us say, between the Truman administration, which had to face the Cold War, and the Eisenhower administration, there has been some difference in the way they faced it? Are you suggesting, Mr. Johnson, that the difference has been a kind of budget wariness on the Republicans' part?
Well, I'm suggesting that in part, budget wariness, both in terms of national defense, and but not so much in foreign aid. The Eisenhower administration has supported this with great vigor. This is one of the few issues President Eisenhower does fight for with congressmen. Well, what I would suggest is that in the late years of the Truman administration, this country got into a very ugly, nasty mood. I should be saying this. Mr. Revere wrote about Joe McCarthy. And the Eisenhower administration has helped bring us out of that mood, both domestically and in terms of foreign policy. So there is a basic consensus, as Mr. Bingham suggests.
Yeah, and I would say that historically, obviously, in both domestic and foreign affairs, we go through a period of expansion and then a period of consolidation. I think we are in a period of consolidation now. Senator Fulbright's proposal about the Development Loan Fund is a very important issue, but it is part of a much larger issue, which has been settled. There are no more isolationists except a few. And in fact, I would say that one of the interesting features of this presidential campaign will be the number of people who say, but he isn't speaking out on the issues. The fact is that not many of us know what they are. They haven't emerged yet. I think that the Democratic Party has what I might call a sort of a nagging wing of liberals who say that we must advance new policies. They're not very clear about what those policies should be. I think some of them tend to be the neo-isolationists. They're so concerned about how we should spend the money in our great affluent society that they don't recognize that we have to spend a lot of that money abroad. They're talking mostly about domestic affairs. A lot of the most liberal people, covert way, are the most isolationist people today. Whereas Mr. Dirksen doesn't argue anymore about spending money for foreign assistance.
Well, I think he argues some. It doesn't do him much good.
I think, though.
Of course, in this question of foreign aid and with so large a part of our foreign policy, it's really an export of domestic policy that we're talking about to a large degree, and the feelings about the thing, not perhaps the voting of funds, but that one of the democratic innovations in a way was simply shipping the welfare state abroad or certain aspects of it,
This is an idea that needs more criticism than it's gotten from liberals.
Yes.
I mean, the idea that if you just spend a lot of money for those nice Indians, we'll somehow have a wonderful world.
Oh, yes.
It needs a lot of re-examination.
Yes, the myth that we'll make people love us by spending money should have been destroyed.
We've all caught up with that,
ago.
But another step needs to be taken
as
to what we will do.
Well, let me push just a little bit in the hope of an ultimate clarification here. Are you gentlemen not saying that there has been a difference in foreign policy? Namely, that in the Truman years, generally speaking, Truman was for heavy expenditures for foreign aid, and that Republicans were critical. There was a difference in degree, so to speak. They said not so much money. Yes, foreign aid, but not so much. That today, this difference, by and large, continues between Republican and Democrat, with Mr. Eisenhower, being in the position of responsibility, at times pushing for more money himself. Is this fair? Is this correct?
You said that Truman was for this.
No, but
no matter what individuals you cite, I would have to say that it was the pressure of events. Mm-hmm. The first step was perhaps Turkish-Greek aid. Mm-hmm. The fact of the matter was that those friendly governments might have fallen to the communists if we hadn't done something. This is what, by and large, prompts our government to take...
No, Mr. Singer, I quarrel at
this
point. I quarrel because it seems to me a man in the White House could decide to do nothing at that point.
Yeah,
he could have, and then we'd have been in great trouble.
Why did he wait so long? I mean, why didn't he act sooner?
I think he was learning the presidency.
It seems to me that what we saw in Europe prompted the Marshall Plan. The Berlin airlift is cited as a great, and I'm in agreement, a great gesture on the part of President Truman. But we were up against it before we took the act. And what I'm saying is that it's very rare that our politicians in this country of either party look forward to meet problems before they arise. They meet them when they do arise.
Mr. Revere?
Well, I was going to say that if you attribute it all to the pressure of events, then there's no difference at all. Is that what you're saying?
No. Then I would go on to say that,
in the
that
same
the Democrats,
fashion?
Democrats, by and large, mm-hmm. react more aggressively with more imagination and more vigor. The Republicans are still unwilling to unbalance the budget
think,
if they can possibly avoid
I
it.
I think one has to talk about the quality of responses and the nature of innovations, really. I was thinking when Mr. Johnson was talking that some quite important things have been innovated in the last year. The whole idea of the exchange of visits,
it's
it seems
excellent.
To me. Well, I'm not so sure
is
it's excellent, but
oh, well, all right,
that's as much of an innovation as we've had. It was a tremendous step. Good or bad, inviting Khrushchev to tour this country was something one could not have.
Oh, I'm sorry. When you said exchanges of visits, I misinterpreted. I thought you meant the Soviet Union opening up so scholars can now go and study.
No, I don't mean My Fair Lady. I mean Khrushchev.
As a matter of fact, I would say the Fulbright program for student exchanges was one of the few cases that I could reel off in which politicians foresaw a situation or made something out of what was not a crisis but an opportunity.
Well, now, we seem to have said that there has been something of a difference in the quantity of response.
Mm.
The Democrats have been more willing to spend money on a containment foreign policy than the Republicans, just to put it in general.
Yeah.
Now, I gather we were moving from there to the next point, the difference in the quality of response. Are we ready to maintain that between these two parties there has been, and not passing judgment on it, so to speak, has been qualitatively different? You were moving
on
that line.
Well, yes, I think it has been qualitatively different. I'm not sure that the qualitative difference has much to do with difference in parties. I think since the death of Mr. Dulles, the foreign policy of the United States has been largely Mr. Eisenhower. It's been him. So the same sort of thing might have happened, and if the circumstances applied with the Democrats in power, the same sort of thing could not have happened, I think, if anyone but Mr. Eisenhower had been president. I think that he has, I think he's influenced the presidency greatly by his own personality, and that he and probably he alone in this generation could have done what he's
In effect,
done.
He has legitimized and consolidated the advance of the Republican Party.
Well, I put it this way, tried to put it this way recently, that he has used more of the prestige that he brought to the office as an individual than the prestige and power the office conferred upon him. But I don't think this is a party phenomenon. I think it has much more to do. If one were to deal with it as one would have to say, why did the Republicans choose Mr. Eisenhower, choose a man who would play it this way? That
would
might
you go
you
so far as to say, Mr. Revere, that essentially the same thing would have happened? I read your article in Harper's in which you discussed this point. If Eisenhower had been nominated by the Democrats, which many of them wanted to do, and elected by the Democrats?
I think that the Democratic Party, a Democratic Party that could have and would have nominated and kept in office Mr. Eisenhower, would be a very different organization from the one we know, so that it's
I don't think it can be dealt with. We come back to what we mentioned in the program last week. The parties vary in terms of the quality of the leadership out of the White House. And in this case, I agree with Mr. Bingham, Mr. Revere, that President Eisenhower has consolidated, and in a very tough situation in 53 and 1954, when the Democrats are so bloodied by the attacks on them over Korea, over the fall of Chiang Kai-shek, they really couldn't have done very much, it seems to me, in power.
It seems to me it would be possible to argue that we needed perhaps someone who would rise above politics to let these wounds heal and the
I would contend for the first term, up to 1956.
Yes, of course, it's characteristic of Republicans in general, is it not, to put in the White House someone who would rise above politics.
They haven't done it.
Say that he would.
Often,
oh no, but this is. But the idea, I think, is basically.
You like Mr. Harding?
I would get
no,
back
but
to
in,
the
in
notion.
modern history, surely Wilkie and Dewey represented the Eastern internationalists.
Well, they were the national wing of the party,
yeah,
rather
not
than
above politics.
The presidential candidates are very different from.
I don't
the
want a president
candidates.
Above politics.
No.
I want him part of politics. And I want him in other roles too.
Yes,
in fact, I think the nation probably has I would think there would be a reaction, and you can see it both in Mr. Nixon's character and whoever the Democratic nominee will be, that there will be politicians. I think that the idea that we want to get away from politicians has abated somewhat.
I've kept hearing in both last week's and this week's discussion these words innovation and consolidation. And they called to my mind a column which I think Mr. Reston wrote some 3 months ago, in which he said, the great emerging issue in American politics is innovation versus consolidation, both in the domestic area, where funds have to be used more for the public sector if you're an innovator, where funds should not be used for the public sector if you're a consolidator, and in the foreign area, where if you're an innovator, you want to move as Mr. Johnson wanted to move. If you're a consolidator, by and large, you wanted to continue the Truman-Eisenhower policies. Is Mr. Reston right? Just to finish the question, will the Democratic Party over the next 20 years be the party of innovation, the Republicans the party of consolidation?
I think he's right. But again, we hear a lot of demands for new principles and innovation, but nobody, and it'll be interesting to see if during the campaign someone does speak up with some new policies. I think there are a number of things that we need to continue, but we also need to look forward and meet some new problems. This question, we all talk about disarmament, and we say we want disarmament, but I think no one has talked frankly about what it will mean to the economy if we do get disarmament. This, it seems to me, is a very important foreign policy question.
We had an open line program on that, and even we didn't solve it.
Well, I don't know the answers, but it seems to me that if politicians would address themselves to this kind of problem more frankly, instead of saying we need to continue sending money to the nice Indians.
Yeah. Well, Stuart Chase, Mr. Bingham, has made some very helpful suggestions on this in his new little book, Live and Let Live.
Yes, but he's not a politician.
Well, all right, but politicians do acquire ideas from writers,
slowly,
after all.
Slowly.
Well, maybe, but I must disagree with Mr. Goldman when the way he poses this question.
Right.
Will we have more innovation if we have the Democrats in power for the next 10 years, 20 years? Heavens, not necessarily. It depends which Democrat. What is the quality of mind of the man in the White House? Not whether he's Republican or a Democrat, it seems.
We discussed last week the differences within the parties in the presidential wings, the congressional wings.
Revere is disagreeing.
Well, might one not say that other things being equal, in a general way, the Democrats are, as a party, are more given to innovation. And I think this gets back to a point I tried to make last week, that an essential difference between them is that they, between the parties, is that the Democrats do believe in the uses of government. They think that they're not afraid of the tyranny of the state to the degree that the Republicans are, and they're more willing to experiment in general as a party. Obviously, Senator Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson are rather different, and one might get. But I just think, broadly speaking, this is true. And the Democrats propose as a rule, and a few years later, the Republicans
seems
like to
dispose.
Seems to be
a very good example is a number of apologists for Herbert Hoover say that he had devised most of the things that were later incorporated into the New Deal. But the important fact is that he didn't do it.
Well, his conception of the presidential power was such that even if he had these ideas, he couldn't implement them because he didn't believe in the government
doing
these
things. But here you see the difference in the parties. I mean, he may have seen what would be effective to take account of the problems of the Depression, but he was reluctant to do so. The Democrat was not only not reluctant, but eager. And I think this is a fundamental difference in the parties.
Something of a difference, too, to use the Hoover instance, in the fact that when Hoover did use the government, he tended to use it to stimulate business, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, whereas Roosevelt tended to use it to help and stimulate labor, farmers, et cetera.
Is that entirely true? It seems to me that Roosevelt's, in retrospect, seems to be the champion of the little man, and he certainly was. But a lot of the early steps were directed first at business.
NRA.
The closing of the banks. This was to get the business community back on its feet again so that it would help the working.
You wouldn't go along with this distinction.
I think Mr. Roosevelt improvised and did a lot of things all over the map, some of which were effective and some not effective. And this, it seems to me, is what you can expect, by and large, from a Democratic president.
Well, this innovation and consolidation issue, then, what kind of an answer are we getting here? I think the answer from you three men is that this is not necessarily the issue or the trend or the development. Is that what we're getting?
Well, no, I don't think so, Mr. Goldman. I think Mr. Revere and you, Mr. Bingham, are a little stronger than I am on this innovation per se Democrat. I say innovation depending on the Democrat. I think there's some difference here,
after all. Well, what Democrat are you conceiving as being elected, Mr. Johnson, who is not going to be an innovator in comparison with Mr. Nixon? Let's put it specifically.
Well, if it's a Stevenson-Kennedy ticket, I think you will have innovation, both in domestic and foreign policy. I'm not sure that you'll have very great innovation if it's Lyndon Johnson on the Democratic ticket.
I would agree with that.
Yes, I would agree with that, and I would say that you, if Mr. Nixon is the president, you may have a break in this pattern and a good deal of innovation. I think Mr. Nixon would be quite free at innovating if he thought it were necessary. That is, if, for instance, depression in the next 3 or 4 years. I think Mr. Nixon wanting continued power for himself and his party would do what the situation seemed to him to require.
On that point, Mr.
Or would try to, at any rate, if he might be restrained by his party. And
on that point, whether the Republicans will necessarily be the party of consolidation under Nixon, a quotation. It suggests that if Nixon were elected, in some 4 or 5 years, he would be such an innovator that he would be the hero of the New Republic and of Reporter magazine.
Gracious.
And it goes on, it goes on to say that this is the beauty of a politician's not having any real political convictions. He can move any place the times take him. This, I gather, is where you were going, Mr. Revere.
Yes, I would. I think that's a fair judgment on Mr. Nixon. I think that he's he is as unideological a character, it seems to me, as
that's a fair statement.
As there is.
Well, another way of phrasing it.
I think it's also true to a large degree of Senator Kennedy.
Yeah, it's true of all of them.
In fact, there was an interesting article I didn't wholly agree with in the New Leader a few weeks ago. Called a cool cat for president, and saying that the from the look of things at the moment, we were going to have a cool cat for president in 1960, that both of these men were divorced largely from ideology. I am not to share it, but I think there's the view, but I think there's something in it.
Since the future editorial policy of the Reporter magazine has been bruited about, may I say something? I think there's no doubt that Mr. Nixon will be a much more aggressive, improvising president, would be, than his predecessor. We've had all the consolidation we can use for a while, I would say. And Mr. Nixon is a very smart politician, and he knows that the people want more action from the White House. Many of the things he would do, because he is a smart politician, would be things that I think all of us would approve of. But you mentioned also the matter of principle, and I think that in voting for two men who both promise to be aggressive presidents and improvise, you have to consider on what basis they would proceed, whether they do have more or less principles behind their action.
Yes, and Mr. Bingham, though I was arguing a little while before, now I'm delighted we're all together, that we need a shrewd and gifted politician in the White House. I would disagree with the quotation you read, Mr. Goldman, up to a point, and that is, I would like to have my president with a few basic principles. I do want him to be an experimenter, as Franklin Roosevelt was. He wasn't an ideologue, as some writers have tried to make him in recent years. Not you. I'm not looking at you from that standpoint. But it does seem to me you've got to have a man with certain basic principles, but is pragmatic enough to be able to adjust to the times.
Well, did Mr. Roosevelt have basic principles that would satisfy you? I'm not so sure that he wasn't very much in this category.
No, I would lift him a little above that category, Mr. Revere.
I think there are, I would go along. I think there are some times when he showed himself to be a very hard and almost cynical man in the uses of power. But the point was that he did have basic principles, and he did accomplish things which other men of great principle applauded. So I think.
Well, now, Mr. Johnson is happy that you men are coming together, and I'm unhappy. Let's see if I can separate you. We have just about a minute. There seems to be a certain wistfulness in this discussion as to whether the parties really stand for anything, that some of you seem to want the parties to stand for something more definitely than they do. Is that correct? Mr. Johnson, I think you're especially wistful, aren't you?
Well, no. I want a strong, vigorous president with principles, naturally, because I'm convinced that the president's the only one who can give the American people a lead.
Then you would want an even stronger doctrine of presidential leadership attached to the Democratic Party?
Certainly, more than we've had in the last decade in terms of the presidency.
And Mr. Revere?
Well, I don't hanker after a new party setup particularly. I think our present one has disadvantages in in foreign policy, for example. It's awfully confusing to the rest of the world to find...
And to me.
And to all of us to find everybody everywhere, but I can live with this very nicely.
Mr. Bingham?
I like our large, chaotic political parties. I think they have many faults, but I think they serve as splendid instruments for a good, strong president who knows how to use them to run the government.
Unhappily, gentlemen, I have not been able to separate you. We must close for these 2 weeks of exceedingly sensible discussion. Thank you, Mr. Walter Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Richard Revere. And thank you, Mr. Robert Bingham.
WNBC-TV has just presented The Open Mind. Your host on The Open Mind was Eric F. Goldman, professor of history at Princeton University. Professor Goldman's guests today were Robert Bingham, Professor Walter Johnson, and Richard H. Revere. Next week, the topic for discussion will be political issues of 1960. What should they be? If you have any comments or questions on today's program, or if you have any suggestions for future programs, please send them to The Open Mind, WNBC-TV, New York 20, New York.